From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network, Dr. Ken Hsieh from the University of California at Irvine is interviewed by Gen's editor-in-chief John Sterling about plastic antibodies.
Dr. Ken Hsieh is a professor of chemistry at the University of California in Irvine. His team's research focuses on synthetic chemistry, broadly applied to four main areas. These include synthetic methodology, new polymerization reactions, molecular imprinting, and designer materials. Dr. Hsieh, you and your colleagues have developed what have been called plastic antibodies. Would you describe these in more detail?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Plastic antibodies is the name that we've given to small nano-size synthetic polymer particles that have been designed to function much like an antibody, that is, with the ability to recognize or capture targeted biological macromolecules or other small molecules.
How do you manufacture them?
Well, these are synthetic polymers, and so the manufacturing procedure consists of starting with, the manufacturing procedure is a polymerization reaction. So one starts with a aqueous solution of reasonably common functional polymerizable monomers with an initiator. The polymerization builds up molecular weight, and under the conditions that we've developed, we wind up at the end of the day with a solution of reasonably uniform synthetic polymer nanoparticles, typically in the size range of 30 to 40 nanometers. The polymer nanoparticles are then purified by a dialysis technique, not too different from the way one purifies proteins. And we're left at the end of the day with this solution of synthetic organic polymer molecules that we term plastic antibodies.
What advantages do plastic antibodies have over natural antibodies?
Some of the advantages I think we've already demonstrated, but there are others that we think are further down the road. First of all, they're abiotic. That is to say, they are not produced by living organisms. They are completely synthetic. And because they are abiotic, that means one does not need living organisms or cells to produce them. Another factor, if one is comparing them directly with antibodies, is their cost. Since our building blocks are relatively inexpensive and readily available monomers, polymerizable monomers, the cost of producing these and subsequent purification is much, much lower than the cost of producing antibodies. Another possible benefit of these, or advantage, would be in response to perhaps a pathogen or some target biological molecule, we can produce materials relatively quickly with an affinity for those substances. And so the process from start to end is much faster than the method to produce natural antibodies.
Are there any drawbacks or limitations to the use of plastic antibodies?
Oh, I'm sure. There are many. The fact that these are synthetic polymers, their building blocks are not natural building blocks in the sense that we don't use amino acids or carbohydrates. They are unnatural substances. And so some of the concerns in applications, depending upon what application we're talking about, would be how they are cleared, how they're broken down in the body. Do they elicit immunogenic responses? Are they toxic? All of those questions have to be addressed, certainly in any therapeutic application.
Now, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Darwinian and huge believer in the evolutionary process, so let's explore the comparison between plastic and natural antibodies a little bit further. The natural antibody-antigen reaction has been exquisitely designed by evolution, and it has worked for millions of years as a very complex part of the immune system process. How are your antibodies able to compete so efficiently and work so effectively when compared to this evolutionary marvel that we call natural antibodies?
Well, I'm not so sure that we have to be competitive. And in fact, the functioning of antibodies as an integral part of the immune system is not really the intention of our work that is to replace or compete with. But recall, antibodies have gone far beyond their intended function, that is, an integral part of the immune system. Antibodies are now being used in a variety of applications that had nothing to do with the normal evolutionary process. That is to say, antibodies are being used for therapeutics, antibodies are being used for diagnostics, antibodies are used in purification techniques and things of this sort. And so there are many, many functions. Once the ability to produce antibodies synthetically, many, many applications of these substances that are far afield from their intended natural function that is part of the immune system. So I think how were we able to compete? As antibodies move into these other areas, we now are anxious to see whether, in fact, our synthetic antibodies, the plastic antibodies, are as effective in these other applications.
Could you tell us about some of the experiments you've carried out in animals and talk about both the results you obtained and the significance of these findings?
Well, I think probably the most important step that we've taken is the in vivo studies with mice. And what we did, and this is the culmination of a reasonably long research effort, but what we did was to develop a synthetic antibody, a plastic antibody, against a toxin, which is melatonin. This is a 26 amino acid peptide, and this toxin is the principal toxin of bee venom. When you're stung by a bee, the bee injects this particular peptide toxin. Through a iterative process, we developed these synthetic polymer nanoparticles that had a high affinity and selectivity for the toxin melatonin. Now, most of these studies were done in sort of the pristine environs of a laboratory, not in the real world, so to speak. And so the big step that we took, following some in vitro studies where we demonstrated the nanoparticles themselves were not toxic, we then moved into animal studies where, once again, after establishing that the nanoparticles themselves were not toxic to the mice and did not elicit an immunogenic response, the experiments that we performed consisted of injecting mice with a lethal dose of the toxin melatonin. What happened next was there was a follow-on injection shortly thereafter with a solution of our synthetic antibodies. And what we did was to observe the survival curves. The control, where there was no nanoparticles, just the toxin, did not make it. That is, a lethal dose was administered. However, what we observed in the studies where we injected, after the toxin was injected, our nanoparticles at varying concentrations, that is, the survival of the mice increased as a direct function of the amount of nanoparticles that we injected. Now, this is a situation where the toxin is circulating in the blood and causing havoc in the living organism. What was necessary for our nanoparticles to have an influence or some effect on that system was to capture the toxin in the bloodstream, which consists of 7% by weight of proteins, perhaps more than 2,000 different proteins. Our nanoparticles had to selectively capture the toxin, sequester it, and eventually it was cleared by the system and wound up in the liver. This is the important set of experiments that I think we did to show that these synthetic polymer nanoparticles actually functioned, that is, the ability to recognize a single toxic peptide in the presence of an ocean of different peptides and proteins in a living organism and to produce a biological response.
Now, without giving away any of the information you might be shortly publishing, is there something you can describe about the current work being done in your lab to advance this original work done with the antibodies?
Yes, very much. One of the directions that were taken is similar to the experiment that I just described, antidotes for toxins. They can be snake venom or insect toxins and things of that sort. There are a number of molecules not very different from the peptide melatonin that we described previously. There are a number of these toxins for which it would be very nice to have relatively cheap, abundant antidotes. And so one of the thrusts of our research is to develop antidotes for these toxins that might be produced relatively economically and may be stored, because these are more robust than antibodies, and may be stored for long periods of time under conditions where that are not particularly good for rather fragile biological macromolecules such as antibodies. So toxin neutralization, or antidotes, would be one thrust. We're also pursuing the use of these materials as in protein purification, replacing certain standards that have been used to purify proteins with our synthetic polymer nanoparticles. We're also considering applications in diagnostics as well. So everywhere that antibodies are being used in contemporary research or in some of the specific applications that I've described, we have our feelers out, so to speak, to see if we can develop and compete in this case with the real antibodies.
Okay, so here's a question journalists always ask, and sometimes researchers answer it. Sometimes they get a little nervous, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How does this what does this technology need to do to advance before it can be considered a viable candidate for research on humans?
Now, the research on human question, of course, is decidedly more complex. Any therapeutic application for humans requires a very long chain of events to take place to demonstrate safety and efficacy. That would be associated with visions of therapeutic applications, antidotes, for example. If that were to be reduced to practice, there would have to be a substantial investment to demonstrate that there are no deleterious side effects or complications that, in fact, would be worse than neutralization of the toxin. And this is why we're pursuing not only selected potential therapeutic applications, which have a substantially longer timeline and, of course, price associated with establishing their efficacy. But this is why we're pursuing, in a number of cases, non-therapeutic applications, those, for example, in protein purification or in diagnostics. So the timelines are difficult for me to put on. We would have to have what I would think a killer app, and we would obviously need support from companies that do this sort of thing for a living.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.